and call up our presentation material and bring on your very first presenter, again, Mary Beth Sheridan, who's joining you from EPA. Mary Beth, whenever you're ready to begin, please do.
Okay, welcome everyone to our third and final webinar on the Generator Improvements Rule. We'll take questions at the end, but you can, as Jean said, submit them at any time, and that helps us get organized to answer them. And if you have questions from either of the first two webinars, you can feel free to post those also, and we will see if we can get to them. So we're going to start today with the changes that we made that relate to small and large quantity generators. As you may remember, last time we talked about a couple of major new provisions that were mainly aimed at very small quantity generators. So today we're going to go over the ones that apply to the larger generators. I'm going to start with satellite accumulation areas. They're now found in their own section of the regulations, which is 262.15. For those of you who are really familiar with how the RCRA generator regs were laid out, they used to be kind of in the middle of 262.34 and not their own section. So now we've set them apart. And just to remind people what a satellite accumulation area is, it's a location at a generator's facility where the generator accumulates small amounts of hazardous waste, up to 55 gallons of regular hazardous waste or 1 quart of acute hazardous waste. And it has to be, it's in containers, and it has to be at or near the point of generation and under the control of the operator. So a satellite accumulation area does have fewer requirements than the central accumulation area, provided you comply with those requirements that are found in 262.15. So we didn't really, this program has always existed. What we did was we made some clarifications and revisions to try to bring it more in line with the overall central accumulation area standards where we thought it was necessary. So the changes are fairly minor, but we do want to go over them today. So the first one is that we explicitly stated in the regs that hazardous waste in satellite accumulation areas can't be mixed or put in containers with other hazardous waste that's incompatible. So it's basically applying the same storage requirement for incompatible waste at the SAA that already existed at the CAA. The second change is that we do allow for containers to remain open temporarily under limited circumstances in an SAA. That's a little broader than what's allowed in the CAA. So there were two specific situations that we allowed for, and that is the proper operation of equipment. So if the satellite accumulation area has equipment like piping or tubing or something that's connected to the container, if it's necessary for it to be open for that equipment to work properly, then that's okay. And the second one is to prevent dangerous situations such as the buildup of extreme heat or pressure. So again, this is just temporarily while the container is, you know, while something's being added or removed is also allowed, that's the same in a central accumulation area. But there's a couple other exceptions that are allowed in the satellite area. But once those situations are done, then the container has to be closed. So if the contents were too hot to close the container right away, once it's cooled, the container needs to be closed. Then the next change that we did to the satellite accumulation area standards is we added a weight limit for acute hazardous waste. So as you remember, it's 55 gallons for normal hazardous waste, and it was 1 quart for acute hazardous waste. Once it reaches that limit, it has to move to the central accumulation area within 3 days. But there wasn't a weight limit, and especially for the small because it's such a small amount for acute hazardous waste, we did get some comments that that was, would be helpful. So basically, the equivalent of a quart is, in weight, is 1 kilogram. Another change that we made, or this was a clarification, so we've always said that you had to move, once you reach that limit, you have to move it in within 3 calendar days to the central accumulation area or off-site to a permitted TSDF. So we just clarified in the regulations that 3 days means 3 consecutive calendar days. Then we also rescinded a memo that was specific to reactive hazardous waste at the satellite accumulation area. We did allow for that to be, in the memo, we allowed for that to be stored away from the point of generation. But in redoing the regulations, we decided that if the reactive hazardous waste is so dangerous that it can't be stored near the point of generation, then it really needs to go right to the central accumulation area. So that memo is no longer valid. And then the last thing we did related to the regulations was we made it consistent, the marking and labeling, with the central accumulation area. So this is something we went over in the first webinar. The words hazardous waste always had to be on the drums, but in this new rulemaking, we added that you have to add the hazards. So we've said in the satellite area, those need to go on, as well as in the central accumulation area. So you don't need an accumulation start date, but again, you do have to move it within 3 days if you reach that accumulation limit. Okay, a couple other, these are in the preamble to the 2016 rule. We did some clarifications related to what under the control of the operator means. And we basically, it means that the operator has to be someone that's familiar with the operations that are generating the hazardous waste. They have to be aware of and able to attend to these operations if needed. And there has to be, they have to provide some measure of controlled access. And then we gave examples of, because this is a key part of being considered a satellite accumulation area, being under the control of the operator. So we gave the examples in the preamble. It doesn't mean it has to be controlled by key. It can also be controlled by other means like access card or lockbox. You know, the operator would be considered, it would be considered to be controlled by the operator if the waste is in a locked cabinet and the operator has control of that key, even if the room is not controlled. You know, anyone can go in and out of the room. Other ways the operator can control the area is if they have, you know, they're in regular view of the SAA as part of their job, and if they're able to see if anyone enters or exits the SAA. And of course, you can have more than one operator of an SAA. So if you're a facility that's running, you know, 24 hours a day, if you can have one operator in the daytime, one operator, and a different person be the operator at night. So that's fine. Okay, so that was what we did with satellite accumulation areas. This next change is just a small change to a requirement in that only applies to LQGs. And the regulations previously said that if you had either ignitable or reactive hazardous waste, you had to keep those at least 15 meters or 50 feet from the property line. And there wasn't any exceptions for this. And over the course of, you know, 30-something years, we've heard that this is a problem, especially in urban areas, where sometimes the properties are pretty narrow. So in the 2016 rule, we did allow for a site-specific waiver for a large quantity generator to use that to request an exception to the rule if they couldn't meet the 50-foot requirement. So they would submit the waiver to the authority having jurisdiction over the fire code. which is typically the fire marshal or the fire department. And then that person would be able to tell them what precautions they could take to make it safe for their situation, and they could store hazardous waste within 50 feet. So that is a new waiver that's allowed under the new provisions. Okay, now I'm going to turn it over to Kathy to talk about some of the other provisions that relate to FPGs and LPGs.
Hi. We have a couple other small changes that we're going to touch on, starting with the revisions to the requirements for drip heads and containment buildings for small quantity generators. Basically, why we made this change is that the regulations prior to 2016 for drip heads and containment buildings, they only addressed large quantity generators and TSDFs, and they didn't specifically talk about what the requirements were for small quantity generators that were accumulating hazardous waste in these units. What the default seemed to be was that small quantity generators would have to comply with all of large quantity generator regulations if they were using a drip head or a containment building. So what we did in the 2016 rule was to make some specific standards for SQGs using drip heads and containment buildings. And we stated that those SQGs can use those units. They do have to continue to use the standards for the units that are found in Part 265, subparts W and DD. So that's W for drip heads and DD for containment buildings. They do have to use those technical standards, but then they also have to meet the conditions that we specified for SQGs in 262.16. And those are found in, I note that there's a citation missing from the slide here. Those are found in 262.16b, 4, and 5 for drip heads and containment buildings. And those other conditions, they talk about labeling and record keeping, that kind of thing, specifically for drip heads in 4 and containment buildings in 5. And then we also restated some technical guidance about VSQGs being able to accumulate hazardous waste on drip pads if they comply with subpart W standards. We did want to note that those SQGs only have 90 days to accumulate hazardous waste if they're using a containment building, so that is a little bit of a different thing for SQGs. So that is drip pads and containment buildings. We also have another small change regarding personnel training for LQGs. And the only change in here you'll note is that we've added online training or computer-based or electronic training as something that is a way for facility personnel at an LQG to get the training that they need under RCRA. So we decided that seems like lots of people are doing online training. It's probably pretty similar to classroom instruction in a lot of ways, and we thought we would allow that for personnel training for those LQGs. Now we are going to talk about emergency preparedness and planning and the changes made to this section. We did make kind of a wide variety of revisions to the planning and preparedness standards. So as a part of the reorganization, if you recall, under the old regulations, 262.34 basically referred SQGs and LQGs to Part 265, subpart C and D, or a combination. But we decided that we would make it more specific to the generator categories and put the SQG preparedness, planning and preparedness standards into 262.16 with all the other SQG conditions. And you're going to find those in B8 and 9. And then for the LQG standards, We do have a reference in 262.17A6, but it turned out that those standards for LQGs, it was a little bit long to put right into 262.17, so we did give it its own subpart within Part 262. So Part 262 of the federal regulations is the generator regs, so someone no longer has to jump all the way to the TSDF regs, but they do have to look within a little bit later in 262 to find subpart M to find the emergency planning for LQGs. There are four basic things that we addressed that I'm going to go over today, including the scope of the regulations, the contingency plan quick reference guide, some revisions to the documentation of the arrangements that the generators make with their emergency responders, and then a few technical changes that we made within the regs. So when looking at the scope of the emergency planning, preparedness and planning regulations, the old regulations were silent on where these requirements were applicable. So that resulted in some generators thinking that the regulations applied to their whole facility, and others thinking that the regulations only applied to the 90-day area or the CAA. The new rule specifies that these hazardous waste regulations only apply where there is hazardous waste, so at generation and accumulation areas. There is some flexibility built into the language regarding the needed equipment. That's in 262.252. So there's a little bit of flexibility there. And then we also want to note that we have long supported the one plan for generators, especially for those generators that have contingency planning requirements under multiple statutes. And these rules do continue to support the use those generators using the interagency one plan to make their contingency plans. As far as the contingency plan quick reference guide, so this is only for LQGs. I want to make sure that we note that contingency planning is just for LQGs. They're already submitting contingency plans to their emergency responders. But what we heard from the emergency responders was that these long binders of contingency plans, they really were proving not useful during an immediate response. So what the quick reference guide is, and I'll talk a little bit about it in specifics in the next few slides, but what it is that the idea behind it is to provide the most critical information for an immediate response when responders are headed towards a facility. There is a staggered rollout for this requirement. If you look at the second and third bullets on the slide, you'll see that new LQGs who are submitting contingency plans have to do a quick reference guide as a part of them, and then existing LQGs need to include a quick reference guide when they're otherwise updating and submitting their contingency plan to their responders. So that's the staggered rollout for this provision. Now, there are eight elements in the quick reference guide. Again, these eight elements, they came from our discussions that we had with the emergency responders. And they are the types and names of hazardous waste and associated hazards. And I want to note that this is not a list of waste codes. We do talk a little bit about what we mean by this, and it is a, you know, it could be a list of kind of plain language terms for what kind of hazardous waste are at the facility, like maybe spent solvents or flammable solvents or something like that. An estimated maximum amounts of hazardous waste that could be found on site, hazardous waste that require unique or special treatment, a map showing where the hazardous waste are generated, accumulated, or treated at the facility, a map of the facility itself and surroundings that can be used to identify routes of access and evacuation, location of a water supply, identification of on-site notification systems. So that would be whether the facility has a PA or has, you know, uses a system of bells or alarms or what they use to notify the people who are out on the floor of their facility in the case of an emergency. And then also the name of an emergency coordinator and or a 24/7 emergency telephone number. And we also state that we do encourage that the generators work with their local emergency authorities and others to identify any additional information that would be useful to be included in this guide. We are aware that there are some challenges regarding the quick reference guide, and we are working through our users group, which I think Mary Beth might talk a little bit about later at the end of the presentation, to talk to the states about what kind of guidance might be useful coming out of EPA or that we can develop together as far as how to implement this provision and helping the states and generators figure out what is going to make it the most useful. So we are working on guidance in that area right now. We do have an example. I have to credit Region 7 for putting this together and their implementation of the rule in Iowa. They put together this example and let us borrow it for our presentation. It is a little bit small, but hopefully if you can't see it on your screen, you can print up these pages and look at it. So all the elements are accounted for in this three-page quick reference guide that they put together. A quick reference guide wouldn't have to look exactly like this. I have actually seen an example of one out of one of the states that someone sent me that does look a lot like this. So that I think they use this as a template. So you could share it if that was useful to your generators. But it does include all the elements. So if you look at it, you have, I have a pointer, don't I? thank you. So if you look up here, you're going to see the name of the facility, and those are the emergency coordinators and the phone numbers there. Then in this table, you have kind of layperson terms for the names of the waste that are likely to be found on site. They included both the waste codes and the hazards here. The waste codes wouldn't be required. The location where the waste is accumulated, also not strictly required by the standards, but probably useful. Maximum amounts present. Some notes for responders that might be useful, and then any kind of unique hazards special notes. So that's that first page. And then this is the one that's really kind of hard to see, but this would be a map of the facility, and they've marked off both the satellite accumulation areas as well as where the fire alarms are and telephones. Also, they've noted evacuation routes on this little map, as well as a couple of extra notes that might be useful to emergency responders down at the bottom. And then on the third page, this is their street map that locates the fire hydrant and just gives a sense of what this facility is surrounded by and how the emergency responders might access it. So this is an example. We do want to thank Region 7 for putting it together for us. So that's the quick reference guide. Moving on to other changes within emergency preparedness and planning is the revisions to making and documenting arrangements by the generators. So this applies to both SQGs and LQGs, and it isn't a new requirement that the generators have to make arrangements, but there are two changes. One was that we included local emergency planning committees on the list of the potential first responders or emergency responders, since in some parts of the country we have learned that the LEPCs do fill that role in a community. In some places they don't, and they are more of a meet once a year kind of board. But in some places those LEPCs are filling an active on the ground role. So we wanted to make sure that they were included. And then we also revised the old requirement to document when a generator could not make arrangements with local responders. And we revised that to be that the generator must document when arrangements are made in the facility record as well. So if they attempt to make arrangements and they're unable to, they have to document that. But if they do manage to make their arrangements with the emergency responders, they document that as well. Either way, the generator has to put documentation in the operating record about the arrangements that they've made. We really think that this revision, it emphasizes the importance that these relationships between the generators and the local responders have. And it emphasizes the importance of letting responders know if they're going to come across hazardous waste at a facility. So, and we thought it was valuable to make that revision about documenting the arrangements. Also helps implementing agencies, if they go into a facility, facility can show them evidence of making their arrangements instead of just saying that they did it. And then we also made some technical changes in the regulatory text that I'm just going to go through briefly, and you can look at your leisure. But the first one is that LQGs can eliminate unnecessary employee personal information that used to have to be in the contingency plan. We decided that that was having addresses and home phone numbers of employees was not necessary anymore when probably most people can be accessed with a cell phone, or there's, you know, one phone number that can be forwarded. I think that technology is available in most places, so we decided to take that personnel information out of the contingency plan. Also, we made some changes about SQGs and LQGs being able to determine the most appropriate locations for their emergency equipment. There were some cases that we heard about where it wasn't safe to have equipment located immediately next to the generating equipment for whatever reason. So we added a little flexibility there. We added the phrase direct or unimpeded access to the meaning of the term immediate access. We've gotten a lot of questions about immediate access and what we meant by that. Hopefully that explanation helps a little bit. We stated that for SQGs, the location that relevant emergency response information should be posted is next to the telephone. We did get some questions on the next bullet about SQGs and whether they can use contractors to address releases because of the way the reg text was phrased. So we clarified that they can do that. They don't have to clean releases up themselves, as in their own personnel. They can use outside contractors to do that. And then we added a waiver for entering into arrangements with local authorities for those large facilities that have internal response capabilities. So those citations are all there on the slide. You can take a look at those changes to see how you think about them. We already talked about closure in our last webinar last week. If you are interested in these slides as I go through them and didn't get to attend that one last week, it is recorded, and you can go and listen to it after we are done here. And that was towards the end of that that session last week that we talked about closure. But I'm going to skip over these and move on to our next module. So our Module 5, it is a little bit of a review, but it's talking specifically about what the record keeping and the reporting requirements are all throughout the rule. So in some cases, we've already talked about these record keeping and reporting requirements. We are going to look specifically at the site ID form and the changes that were made there. And we also know that in the states and at the generators also, sometimes the people who are dealing with the record keeping and the reporting are doing all the record keeping and reporting, and they don't necessarily care about the details of where that SAA is and that kind of thing, but they just want to know what all the record keeping requirements are. So we did want to put all these slides together in one place to go over so we could look at them in a holistic manner. So I'm going to talk about the record keeping requirements. What we have is 6 new areas where there are record keeping requirements in the 2016 rule. There's under episodic generation, under VSQG consolidation, under the tanks, under closure, under the 50-foot waiver, and in making arrangements with the local authorities. So for episodic generation, the new record keeping requirement is maintaining the records of the episodic event and any approved petitions, maintaining those records in the operating record of the facility for 3 years. Again, if you missed last week and you have questions about episodic generation and VSQG consolidation, last week was when we talked about these in the second part two of these 3 webinars. Under VSQG consolidation, the record keeping requirements are that the LQG has to keep the records of the shipments that they get from the very small quantity generator for consolidation. They have to keep those records for 3 years. Those can be normal business records, and they have to identify the name, site address, and the contact information for that very small quantity generator, as well as a description of the hazardous waste, the quantity of waste, and the date that the waste was received. For tanks, this is something that we haven't talked about. There is a requirement that you can find in the regulations at 262.16b6 and 262.17a5 about using the logs and the monitoring equipment and other records to demonstrate that hazardous waste is moving through a tank within the either 180 days for a small quantity generator or 90 days for a large quantity generator. That it has to be in order to comply with the RCRA requirements. So LQGs have to have, you know, always can only be accumulated for 90 days. For SUGs, it's only 180 days. And basically what these revisions do is they talk about how the logs and the monitoring equipment and other records that are related to the tanks can be used to make sure that those 2 time frames are being complied with. The regulations address tanks that work in batch or in continuous flow processes. In this case, the records have to be kept on site and have to be readily available for inspections. And we do say that ideally they'll be in close proximity to where the waste is being accumulated. But if that's not practical, for whatever reason, they can't be in a control room or another central location at the facility. Under the closure requirements, which we talked about last week, there's record keeping that has, if a unit is closed, and the whole facility isn't closed at the same time, then information about that closed unit has to be maintained as part of the operating record. Under the 50-foot waiver, which Mary Beth talked about earlier this afternoon, if they receive a waiver from the authority having jurisdiction, the generator has to maintain that waiver as part of their operating record. And then, as I spoke about just a few minutes ago, in making arrangements with local authorities for emergency preparedness purposes, a record of those arrangements or an attempt to make the arrangements has to be kept as part of the operating record. So that is a summary of all the new record-keeping requirements under the 2016 rule. And I'm going to turn it back to Mary Beth to talk about reporting requirements.
Okay. So similar to what Kathy said about all of the record-keeping, reporting we've talked about in different places, but this is where we're putting it all together and also showing you what it looks like on the site ID form. So the first one I'm going to talk about is, well, the site ID form itself, most of you are, I'm sure, aware of, is known as Form 8700-12, and we did update it as part of this rulemaking, and this is a link on our website to the form. A lot of the states do allow electronic reporting, so if the generators in those states should check with the state and then use the electronic reporting system to submit these new reports. So one thing we haven't talked about yet is that SQGs are going to be required to re-notify every 4 years. So this is a change. You know, up until this point, large quantity generators had to do the BINO report, so they were basically re-notifying every 2 years, but there was no requirement for SQGs. And we realized over that we don't have, as in doing this rulemaking, that was one of the times that we realized we don't have very good data on SQGs. So some states do require this, and if those states require more frequent re-notification, then the generators would comply with that state's time frame, but we would want the states to then transfer that information into RCRA info according to the timetable above the 4 years. So this is, we are phasing this in because we do realize it's a pretty big universe and it's going to take some time. So the first date will be September of 2021. And then the SQGs will have to re-notify every 4 years after that. And we also chose to do it on September to be kind of off cycle of the BINO report, which is due March 1st. So this way we're hoping to not overburden the states and the people that work on the databases. Like I said, our data is very old. We haven't required this at a federal level, so you know a lot of SQGs have gone out of business, and the data doesn't reflect that. So now by doing this, we'll be able to get better data and do better oversight and program management. This is what the site ID form will look like. For the SQG, they'll check the first box because they're going to re-notify, and then they will go through and update any of the information that was on their original site ID form. We do assume or realize that this is going to be a pretty big undertaking, so we are planning to try to focus on this starting this year and then, you know, until it happens in September 2021. So for the states and regions that are on the webinar, and that if you have any ideas on things that we could do to help with this effort or ways to reach out to the small quantity generator universe, we would be interested in hearing those. So the very last slide of the presentation has our contact information, so you can let us know if you have any ideas about that. So some other new reporting requirements. So the LQGs that consolidate waste from VSQGs, that if they're all under the same company, this is a new provision that we're allowing since the rule came into effect. They have to notify using the site ID form, and they're notifying that they're participating in the program, and then they're going to fill in the addendum, and that's a new piece of the site ID form that we created. In the addendum, they would list the VSQGs that are participating. So the first thing they would do would be the checkbox 14 of the site ID form that they are choosing to do this. And again, remember, this is basically the same company. The LQG and the VSQGs have to be under the same company. And then they'll check that box, and then they would go to and fill in the addendum that's specific for LQG consolidation. And it's just lists the VSQGs that are participating in the program, their address, contact information, and a contact name. And as many as VSQGs are participating, they would need to list them there. And I think I know I mentioned this last week when we were talking about this provision. This reporting will allow us to have oversight and also make sure the LQG is complying with the rules provision, and it will also enable us to monitor the program to see how it's being used and how many people are participating, and we, you know, may choose to expand it in the future. For episodic generation, which is also a brand new provision, they would also notify using the same form. They have to notify at least 30 days before the event if it's planned, or within 72 hours if it's unplanned. And this is the list of the information that they're going to include, the start and end date, the reason for the event, the types of hazardous waste generated, the estimated amounts that are going to be generated, and an emergency contact and emergency phone number. So this is what it looks like. The site ID form, it's box 13. They would check that they're either an SQG or VSQG that's holding an episodic event. And then they also have an addendum to fill out. And this is what it looks like. As I mentioned, you know, you're going to check what type of event, is it planned or unplanned? Because as you remember when Kathy went over this last week, you can only have one planned and one unplanned event per year. And it gives the dates right in the middle here. The beginning and end date, remember they have to be within 60 days. And then the other information that I mentioned, the waste codes and estimated quantity. Okay, for biennial reporting, we made a few changes to this part of the program. So remember, LQGs, at least at the federal level, it's just LQGs that have to submit the biennial report. So we clarified that in the regulations. We also, instead of listing in the regulations all of the information that has to be provided by the LQG when they do their biennial report, instead, we're putting that in the instructions to the biennial report form, which is 8700-13, because it was too hard to keep up the biennial reports every other year. It was too hard to keep up the information in the regulations up to date. So we will issue a Federal Register notice and give the public an opportunity to comment if we do change what is being required to be reported, but we're not going to update the regulations every other year. And other minor clarifications, we put in the regulations that the LQGs have to identify all the hazardous waste they generate throughout the year, even if there are months where they're not an LQG. So this is something that has been the source of confusion over the course of the RCRA program, and we just decided that there was conflicting guidance. We decided it made the most sense for them to report all of the hazardous waste they generated that year. And then if they're participating in the consolidation program, then the LQG will also list that waste in the binary report, but using a different source code, which is G51, when they do their binary report. And then the last piece is we are now requiring facilities, if they're a recycler that doesn't store, so they don't have a RCRA permit, but they receive hazardous waste, we are specifically requiring them to complete binary reports. So that's a new, we don't think there's that many of these facilities, but there are some, and so they are now required to do the binary report too. So if you're a recycler, you would check the second box on your reason for submitting, which is you're submitting your hazardous waste report for whatever reporting year. And then there's a specific box, 10, that talks about you're a recycler of hazardous waste, and you would check either you do store before recycling or you don't store. So in this case, we're assuming this is a new facility reporting, and we would have that, they would check box B, 10B, and saying that they don't store before recycling. And then they would go on to do the binary report. Okay, closure. There's two ways to report this. If you're just closing a waste accumulation unit and not your facility, you do have the option of just placing your notice in your operating record that Kathy mentioned. And you have to do that within 30 days. Or you can go ahead and do the full closure report, which is using the same site ID form. But if you're closing the whole facility, you have to use the site ID form. And you would notify EPA or the state no later than 30 days before closing. And then after you've closed, you have to notify a second time within 90 days that you've either complied with the closure performance standards or you're notifying that you can't clean clothes and you have to close as a landfill. There is the option for the LQG to request an extension, but you have to do this within 75 days of closing. So this is basically designed to give the state or regional EPA personnel time to go out and inspect the facility. So they'll know before they close, and they'll know when they're planning to close, and they can go out and see if they think they've done a good job. If they, you know, this is up to the state or EPA if they feel like they need to. Again, it's the site ID form, and this is box 15. So a facility would check that they're closing either their central accumulation area or the entire facility. So in this case, we said they're closing their entire facility. And then they would put in their closure date. So this form would be due 30 days before that. And then once that time passes, they would close the facility, and then they would resubmit this form, and then they would check either the date closed, so box D, and then whether they closed according to the performance standards or that they couldn't clean clothes, or they could request a new date, which is under box C. So, you know, a state should get at least two of these. They should get a kind of a pre-closure and then a post-closure notice using the site ID form. Okay, and then the last reporting requirement, which we won't go into much detail because Kathy just talked about it, but remember the LQGs, when they either, if they're new, they have to submit it as part of their contingency plan, or if they're an existing LQG, when they update their contingency plan, they're going to have to include a quick reference guide, and it has, you know, 8 different elements that we think are important for responders to have quick access to. So that's it for record keeping and reporting. And then our last module that we're going to go over is just a little bit about implementation and state adoption. So I will go on to that. So as we've said earlier, the rule was signed in 2016. Here's the citation. It was published in the Federal Register in November of 2016, and it went into effect 6 months later federally, which was May 30th, 2017, which basically meant it went into effect in Iowa, Alaska, and then most of the territories and tribal lands, because EPA runs the program in those areas. The rest of the majority of the states run the RCRA program, so they have to go through the state adoption process. And this rule has some pieces that are more stringent, some pieces that are less stringent, and some pieces that we decided were what we call equally stringent. So the authorized states do have to pick up the more stringent provisions. Typically, it would have been by July 1st, 2018, or if they have to do a state law change, then they have another, they get an extra year, so they have until July 1st, 2019. So they do need to eventually pick up the more stringent provisions. However, they can choose whether to pick up the less stringent provisions and those provisions that we considered equally stringent. For example, the reorganization of the regulations is considered equally stringent. So this next slide shows you the more stringent provisions and the less stringent provisions. So the first about 9 or 10 bullets are more stringent, and those are things the states will have to eventually adopt. So, and it mostly revolves around reporting and record keeping. So the SQG renotification is an example that's more stringent. You know, the biennial report changes, the quick reference guide, notification of closure, all of those are more stringent. But also requiring SAAs to be included in emergency preparedness and prevention is more stringent. Identifying the hazards on the labels and adding the RCRA waste codes prior to shipment is more stringent. And then the LPGs having to close their container storage areas. If they can't close those, if they can't clean close, then they have to close as a landfill. Those are all more stringent. The less stringent are the two new pieces that apply to the smaller generators, the VSQG consolidation at the large quantity generator, if it's under the control of the same company, episodic generation that applies to VSQGs and SQGs, and then the last one is the waiver from the 50-foot rule for LQGs. Those are less stringent. So the state has to decide if they want to pick them up. Of course, we would like, we think the whole package makes sense together, so we are encouraging states to pick it all up, but it is, you know, up to them if they want to. Okay, this slide just gives you a list of the resources that we have available for generators. The first one is our main generator website. So this has some basic information. It has links to new regulations, including this one, but also new regulations that come out that affect generators, like the Farms Rule that just was signed and published not too long ago. It also has some links to different sectors that generate, you know, typically have hazardous waste generators in them, and then links to the forms that we've talked about, the site ID form and the biennial report. The next bullet is the Generator Improvements Rule website itself, and that, of course, includes the Federal Register notice, but it also includes some references and specific to this rulemaking. So it includes the next two, the link, and I'm going to show you a picture of the map, but there is a link to the map of the states that have adopted the new generator improvements rule, and also below that map, there's the list of states and their specific regulations. There's some FAQs that we developed as part of giving the training and giving webinars over the last couple years. We put together some of the more frequently asked questions, and that's on that website. And then we also do plan to and have updated web pages and websites where we can. And we're planning to do some more work in that area. One thing we're working on right now is we're updating the small business guide for managing hazardous waste. That is on our general main generator website, but it's pretty out of date. So we're working to update that right now and hope to have it done by the summer, I would say. And we will put it on the website. And as Kathy mentioned, we do have what's called a generator users group, and this is for the states and EPA regions that are implementing the new rule. I'm sure some of you are on that work group, but if your state is about to pick it up in the near future and you want to be part of that, just send Kathy Lett an email with your information, and she'll add you to the users group.
You don't even have to be about to pick it up. Okay. If you're working on, you know, learning and getting up to speed with the rules, which you must be because you're here today, then the work group's for you. We meet monthly, and, you know, sometimes we have announcements from headquarters, but generally it's just the participants on the group bringing questions, and, you know, we facilitate a discussion. If we know the answers, we share them, but a lot of times it's the states giving answers to each other about how they're going about implementing it. So we do have some good discussions, so join up if you are interested.
Okay, and so this is the picture of the map of where the rule has been adopted and is in effect. As you can see, we're getting close to half, if you count the states that have adopted and the states where EPA administers. So, and that is, like I said, is on the website, and it also has links below the map. It has links to the states with their specific regulations. One note, Washington did just adopt, and so the actual map on our website is Washington is blue, so it's going to be effective, I believe, at the end of April, but they have adopted it. So again, if you have any ideas or thoughts on resources that you would like us to develop, or materials that you use and think they still do need to be updated, just email us your suggestions. This last slide has the three of us, our points of contact information. Brian's not here today, but he is part of the generator team, so the three of us can get back to you or, you know, share with each other and figure out what the best way to answer is. And that's the end of the presentation. I think we'll turn to questions now.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'm ready. This is Christine, and I'm going to just switch up the voice for a few minutes and ask some questions of our presenters. So since we just finished with state adoption, let's ask the first question, which is, what is the difference between adopted and authorized?
Okay, so adopted, it's kind of a two-step process. Adopted is when the state, you know, picks up the new rule and puts it into their regulations. And that's basically when facilities can start using it in their state. Authorized is when it's kind of the second step between the region and the state to make sure that the program is kind of as stringent. The state programs have to be as stringent as the federal program. So the it's a process where the region and state work that out and make sure that they are. But they, states are allowed to be more stringent, but they have to be at least as stringent. So I think for facilities, what really matters is that the state has adopted it.
Great, thanks. I'm going to go backwards through our topics. We just talked about reporting, and one of the first reporting questions is, for closure reporting, what if it is a facility that may reopen, such as an idled steel mill or other kind of facility? What would be the requirements there?
I don't think we've addressed this. So I think the state would have to work with the facility on, I guess, you know, the likelihood. We have said that if it's a accumulation area in a facility and they've decided, you know, they're not using it for temporarily, that's not closed. But if the whole facility is idled, I think you'd have to, yeah, I think that's a case-specific determination with the state. But
okay. Oh, this is something I think we covered last time, but it's come up again. Is EPA considering allowing small quantity generators to consolidate waste from very small quantity generators?
Yes. We don't have a timeline for when we would do it, but we assume that, you know, that we'll look at how widely used the program is, and, you know, if we'll definitely check in with the states to see if they think it's something that should be expanded. It would mean a rulemaking, though. So, you know, it's not going to be anything that would be really quick. And then the one thing I did want to mention, too, is we did say if an SQG, because we got this in comments, that there were some industries where they had reduced their hazardous waste so much through waste minimization that they didn't have any LQGs, but they had multiple facilities, and they were wondering, could they have one SQG serve as an LQG? And we said that would be okay as long as they basically turn that SQG into an LQG and comply with all the provisions.
Okay, great. Next question. For renotification under 262.18D, how do we handle facilities that close and assure that they send in notification?
Okay, so this is SQG renotification. Federally, we aren't requiring SQGs to notify that they closed. So if they...
Yeah, I mean, part of what we're doing with having the renotification is to make sure that the data in RCRA info is up to date. So because there isn't a closure notification required for SQGs, that is part of the reason why we have in our database, you know, SQGs that may have closed 20 years ago. And for renotification, there is going to be a bit of a process that is what we're going to start working on this year, where we're going to reach out to the states and encourage that going into 2021, they do have the cleanest SQG data that they could have. And then, you know, because they're going to have, the states are going to have to reach out to your SQGs and, you know, tell them that they need to renotify come September of 2021. So you don't want to be sending out a lot more, you know, I don't know how people are going to do it, if they're going to do postcards or emails or what, but that's part of what we're going to start working on this year. So, but going into the era where we've already started acquiring renotification, so after 2021, I think that if it comes time for the every 4 years renotification, the states will need to reach out to their universes of SQGs and then, you know, remind them to renotify. And if they don't, that's how we're going to figure out which of those SUGs have closed. You know, if they haven't sent in something to let you know. I know that some states have, you know, fee requirements and that kind of thing. I'm not sure if that helps keep your information up to date if some year you don't get, you know, whatever required fee from the generator. But this is going to be another method to keep that data cleaned up. I hope that answers what you were getting at. It was kind of a roundabout approach to an answer.
While we're on this topic, the renotification, will that be for calendar year 2021? Not sure if that.
Yes. It will be, well, in September 2021, SQGs will, they'll have to renotify by that date.
By that date.
So that they're still operating.
Okay, great. So it's not like a yearly thing like some
right.
of our other.
No, and then it will be every 4 years after that. It's not a report. They're not going to like list all the hazardous waste they generated. It's just that they are still an SQG. And, you know, if they have information that's out of date on their, from their first time they got a site ID number, then they would correct that information. But it's not going to be like a binary report. It's just notifying that they still are an SQG.
And it'll be like a snapshot, you know, in September of 2021, these are the SQGs that were in the universe.
Okay, great. All right, changing gears a little bit, we have a question about notifications to LEPCs. So how often do facilities have to make arrangements with LEPC and local authorities? Annually, when processes or waste change, other reasons?
So this actually is something that hasn't, we didn't change this part of the making of the arrangements from the regulations when we updated and moved them in 2016. So the language in this area hasn't changed. The only part of the arrangements that we changed was adding the LEPCs and then adding that documentation. But if you do look at the requirements in the regulations, there isn't a annual arrangement requirement. It just says that they have to make the arrangements. And the regs also don't specify, you know, when processes or waste change. I think that that makes sense, that a facility would, you know, if the things that they are arranging with their emergency responders are changing, like what kind of waste are on site, or if they have done a renovation of their facility and or added a generation process, I think that it would make sense that the generators update those arrangements. That isn't laid out in the requirements specifically like that. But I mean, personally, I think it makes sense. But yeah, we didn't update or tighten that specific part of the arrangement requirement as part of this rule.
Okay, great. A couple of quick reference guide contingency plan questions. Regarding the quick reference guide for contingency plans for small quantity generators and large quantity generators, for TSCFs, we do require a summary of preparedness and prevention items per EPA guidance. But should this same format of the SQG-LQG quick reference guide also be required for TSCF contingency plans?
We did not add this quick reference guide requirement to the TSDF emergency planning and preparedness regs in Part 265. So this is something that is only in Part 262 Subpart M for large quantity generators. We didn't make a corresponding change in 265, which is what we would have had to do to require it for the TSDF. It's my sense, and I might be wrong about this, but it's my sense that the emergency preparedness, under emergency preparedness, the emergency responders are maybe a bit more dialed in with the TSDFs that they have in their regions than necessarily with all the large quantity generators. So, they might already have done more pre-planning with those particular facilities. You know, those TSDFs, they have permits. They had to do public. They had to do, you know, a whole public process to get those permits, that kind of thing. I think the emergency responders may be more aware that those facilities are there and what they look like than all of the LQGs that are in their purview. So that's one of the reasons we didn't make that change to the TSDF requirements that kind of parallel the LQG contingency plan.
Okay, great. Next question. Regarding the contingency plan, if no unique waste is present, does the quick reference guide need to say that, or would it be presumed, if not mentioned, there isn't any?
The requirement is just that any unique waste has to be identified. So if there is none, then I think that there isn't a specific requirement that they would have to say that. It could just be blank.
Okay, great. All right, a couple of satellite accumulation area questions. This is my favorite beginning to a question. The dreaded start date. Does the 55-gallon get dated and then moved after 3 days? And then the drum gets redated once it enters the central accumulation area?
Yes. So if it gets, it only gets dated if if they reach the limit in the satellite area. So if it, in the satellite area, that's the only time you would date it. If you're moving it periodically and it's not full, there's no reason to date it in the satellite area.
Okay.
But if it reaches 55 gallons in the satellite area, you would date it that day. And then you have 3 days to move it to the central accumulation area, in which case you can redate it then. So you would technically could get 93 days if you're LPG. So there is a RCRA online memo about frequently asked questions on satellite accumulation areas. So, and we could maybe add this to the resources, but I'm just going to mention it now. It's RCRA online number 14703. So, and that's dated March 17th, 2004. And that question is addressed in there, as well as some other frequent questions about satellite accumulation areas.
Great. Our questioner is already on it, already aware of that memo. Great. Okay, another satellite accumulation area question. Can two 55-gallon drums staged next to each other, accumulating two different waste streams, both near the point of generation and both under the control of the operator, be considered two separate satellite accumulation areas, or does the proximity of the two drums require that it be treated as one SAA?
I would say if they're really next to each other, then it would be one satellite accumulation area, and it's a limit of 55 gallons total. That is also addressed in that same RCRA online memo. It's 55 gallons of hazardous waste total in a satellite area. So if you have two 55-gallon drums, they need to be, if they both get half full, you're going to have to move them then.
Okay. Great. All right, last question. This one's interesting. Or not last question, because there's a couple coming in. Some R&D facilities have new SAAs constructed and taken down as often as every other day. They have dozens of labs with possibly hundreds of SAAs. How often should these facilities revise their contingency plan if their SAAs are frequently changing?
This is actually among some of the questions that we are talking about in our small group using the users group. The questions basically came out of this exact same question where because the SAAs are included in the contingency planning and because of the requirements for the quick reference guide, we have been getting quite a few questions about very large facilities, very complicated facilities, not just labs, also universities, military bases, that kind of thing. And these are the questions that we are addressing in that group. I think this particular questioner is in the bigger users group, I think, and could join us in our discussions as we try and work through these. We do have some ideas about guidance that we're going to put out, but it is a complicated question. I'm not going to be able to answer it today, so sorry. But we are working on it.
Okay. Great. Back to the Quick Reference Guide question. Will the Quick Reference Guide apply to facilities that are both a TSDF and an LPG?
Okay, this is what we were talking about a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. We did not add the Quick Reference Guide requirement to Part 265. So, no, it does not apply to the TSD. I didn't come out and say it straight like that, so there you go.
Is it possible, though, that there's a TSDF that's also an LQG? Is that maybe what they're asking?
Well, if the LQG, if there's a facility that's a TSDF and is also generating waste and, you know, keeping that in a CAA rather than in the permitted part of their facility, then the LQG requirements are going to apply to them, and they would have to do, you know, all the LQG stuff, including the Quick Reference Guide for their hazardous waste generating and accumulating. So you would have to, you know, I think you would draw a line between the storage that's happening at the TSDF and the generator accumulation that's happening under RCRA.
Okay, great. Next question. Are the states or U.S. EPA contacting small quantity generators and large quantity generators about re-notifying?
Well, I mean, we are planning to work with the states to do outreach to the extent possible. I'm not sure that it will mean contacting every SDG. And the LQGs should already be re-notifying because they have to do the BIDA report. So this, again, the re-notification is specific to the SDGs. We, you know, I guess EPA, that where we run the authorized, where we run the program in that state, we'll be working with, it's usually, you know, through the region. Like Region 7 works with Iowa and Region 10 works with Alaska. We will be working with them to get the word out.
Okay, great. I think we've worked through all the questions that I saw. I think we're good. Are you guys, anything else you want to add?
Okay. Well, then, in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and walk through some of our final reminders before we close things out today. First, I want to thank the nearly 180 individuals who were able to join us for today's live broadcast. I also want to thank our instructors and organizers who took time out of their busy days to put together today's session as well as the others in the series. I'd like to walk through a couple of final items, including some of the most common questions that we get. So if you're looking for a copy of the presentation material, that is already posted on the seminar resource page. So if you follow the link on the middle right of your screen under related URLs and click on the link to seminar resources, then press the browse key button. That should open up that website locally, and you can download a copy of the presentation materials that were used throughout today's series. Contact information about our presenters and organizers is also available, but you're certainly welcome to reach out to me, Jean Balance, reply to any one of the registration confirmation emails if you have follow-on questions. I'll be more than happy to get you in touch with our presenters. And if you could please take a moment to fill out our online feedback form, to let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the content that was covered as well as the method that we used to host today's session. One of the other things that we get asked a lot is if there are CEUs or PEHs for these courses. We do not offer those. However, if you fill out the online feedback form and do two very important things, make sure your email address is entered correctly on that form, and you check the box at the bottom of the form that certifies you were here for the whole session, when you send in your feedback form, you will immediately have access to a participation certificate. We'll email it to you, and you can also download it or print it out right then when you submit your feedback form. If you don't check that box, you won't get a certificate, so it's very important that you do that. If you have a mistake in your email address, you won't get it emailed to you, so just make sure you watch those two things carefully. If you participated in a group, each one of you can follow the link to the seminar feedback form. Again, you'll find that on the middle right of your screen, and fill out that form on your own, whether you registered individually or not. So each person who participates can get their own certificate regardless of the registration method that they use. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow the links. Again, look on the middle right of your screen under related URLs and click that link to seminar feedback. Again, the entire session was recorded, so we will be sending out a summary email to everybody who participated in any of the seminar series parts to let you know where each of the sessions can be found, so you'll be able to access and play the entire workshop back on demand. And with that, I think that's the end of our formal session today. Thank you so very much for joining us. I hope that you'll participate on a future webinar. This is the formal conclusion.